the Cities of Refuge podcast, where we talk about migration, human rights, and the role of cities and local authorities. My name is Barbara Omen, and I'm a professor in the sociology of human rights in the Netherlands and leader of the Cities of Refuge research project. Welcome back, dear listeners, and a very happy new year to you. We make use of this first podcast of 2022 to look back at a really festive event in December when one of the Cities of Refuge PhD students, Tihomir Subcev, defended his PhD at Utrecht University. Congratulations, Dr. Subcev.
Thank you very much.
And as very proud supervisors, Moritz Baumgärtner and myself would like to use this podcast to discuss the findings in your very interesting work. I have it here in front of me. It's titled Local Authorities, Human Rights and the Reception and Integration of Forced Migrants in Greece and Italy. And 2 weeks ago, you stood in the Senate Hall of Utrecht University amongst all the paintings with gray men looking down at you. And you were asked a long line of difficult questions by Maurizio Ambrosini, by Anna-Adrienne de Filidou, by Paulet Hart, Dina Siegel, Paul Minderhout, on various aspects of your PhD. Well, of course, we're not going to do all that again, and the session can be viewed online for anyone who's interested. But we would like to discuss some of the highlights and most interesting findings in your research on Greece and Italy with you. But maybe before we delve into the substance matter, let me ask you, Dr. Subcev, how do you feel after attaining this milestone?
To be honest, I feel great. Thank you very much for hosting me today. It's a pleasure to be at the podcast as a host this time and not as a producer. I would like to say that firstly, of course, I feel a great relief having finished this project. 4 years working on the same topic and every day thinking about the same thing is not easy, definitely. Secondly, I feel a satisfaction, of course, of the achievement and the book that I read, the book that I wrote, and also the fact that I'm coming from quite far away in order to reach this achievement, not speaking in terms of geography, of course, but from another point of view. And finally, it's, of course, a feeling of responsibility, given that this achievement is related to certain expectations in the area of scientific research, but also from a societal point of view.
Yeah. And one of the things people were very enthusiastic about was the plurality of approaches that you take in your book. You look at these two different countries, cases in different countries. You have very complementary theoretical frameworks in all the articles that make up the book. Maybe let's start our questions with where you also started your research in Greece. I know, Moritz, you are, I think, ready to come in with questions on this topic, right?
Yes, and also from my side, congratulations again, Tiho, for defending the PhD. And of course, one podcast episode is not really enough at all to discuss the many findings of your work. And of course, the fact that you take a multitude of different perspectives only makes this harder in a way. So let's zoom in perhaps on one of your two case studies. You had two, Greece and Italy. And in my view, one of the most fascinating aspects of your work is that it really challenges some of the common conceptions regarding refugee reception and integration in Greece, which is usually perceived as negative, if not to say highly negative, also in the media. Whether we talk about a big city like Thessaloniki or even a small island like Tilos, your research, however, demonstrates that, you know, there are real community-wide efforts and indeed a lot of goodwill in Greece to accommodate refugees, even against all odds, as you say or put it in one of the article titles. So two questions on this topic. How common are, in your view, these positive examples across Greece, and how sustainable, perhaps even scalable, are they?
This is indeed a very good question. And what my research showed is first and foremost that Indeed, progressive local immigration integration reception policies can flourish also in a very rocky soil like the Greek one in the last few years. So on the first part of the question, how common are these examples that we have from Greece? I have to admit that they are not very common. In Greece, there is a certain network called Cities for Integration. And this network currently counts 17 municipalities. These municipalities engaged early on from 2016-17, and the network itself was established in 2018, starting with the big cities, Athens and Thessaloniki, and then other smaller towns joining in. And this network basically collects best practices, tries to organize some workshops for municipal employees, and tries to build capacity in Greek local authorities to receive, to integrate refugees locally. At the same time, you understand that these are only 17 out of 325 municipalities in the whole country that have certain progressive approaches towards arriving forced migrants. There are some other examples of municipalities which do not belong to this network, but have developed certain initiatives which are much more limited in their extent and the quality of the local policies and practices they have developed. So on this part, I would say that we have certain developments, but still the examples we have are quite limited. It's not common in Greece to have local reception and integration policies developed by municipalities. On the second part of the question, first, how sustainable are the practices that municipalities developed in the last years? Again, it's very difficult for Greek municipalities to develop long-term policies that will be sustainable and future-proof, if you wish. Why? Because Greek municipalities do not have the mandate in terms of reception of forced migrants and have very limited competencies in terms of integration. In addition, they do not have structural funds, access to structural funds. So the efforts they have developed are mostly project-based. And these project-based efforts, as we know well, usually have a certain start and end date related to certain funding schemes. From this point of view, in my opinion, Greek municipalities will struggle in the future to maintain the practices and the policies that they developed in the last years. And I can give you an example, one small municipality that had access to external funding through international organization. In the last year, this funding was transferred from the international organization to the Greek state. And as a result, the municipality was left for many months without access to funding for the local reception and integration project it had developed, which means not only access to the funds that were necessary for the policy to be implemented, but also for the personnel to be paid. And this shows that in order to sustain these examples, one definitely needs the support of the central government. And of course, I don't know in the example that I just gave if this was because of the incapacity of the Greek administrative system to deliver or for some other reason. But in general, there is not much of effort from the central government in Greece to support municipalities. And this is finally refers to your question on the scaling up the local examples. The central government indeed has to support such examples in order for them to be scaled up. And in Greece, very recently, we had a national strategy for integration that was adopted at the national level. But it is the third such strategy adopted in the last 8 years, and the previous two had never been implemented so far. So I'm skeptical about the extent to which this third strategy will deliver any results. And also in the way it's framed, there is very, very little reference to collaboration with subnational authorities. So it will be difficult, definitely. And in my view, Greek municipalities will probably continue just to remedy some of the problems of the reception and integration framework that exists in Greece or doesn't exist, rather than upscale or sustain the policies they had developed.
Maybe as a brief follow-up, because you also mentioned international organizations and that a lot of the project-based initiatives were actually funded also by international organizations. I know from your PhD, it's the most notably the UNHCR, for example. Is this interest being sustained, the interest that international organizations have in collaborating with local authorities, or is this also something that was there for a moment in the period that you were doing the research and is now fizzling out?
Well, at the first place, international organizations like UNHCR and IOM were in Greece because of the incapacity of the Greek state to deliver in terms of refugee protection, refugee reception, refugee integration. So after a few years, the Greek state decided that it already has the ability to take over these the functions that were expected from it. Then the role of these organizations understandably diminished. Now, still, the Greek state uses these international organizations to implement part of the programs that it designs or it implements together with the European Union, if you wish, with funding from the EU. But at the same time, we see less and less prominent role of these organizations in the country, which reflects also on the relationships that they had developed previously with municipalities. And at some point, I was expecting that the know-how that was developed and the collaboration that was developed between these organizations and the municipalities in Greece would be also transferred in terms of collaboration between the central government and the municipalities in the new emerging framework of migration governance in Greece. Unfortunately, for the moment, I do not see this happening. There are some indications that the central government wants to collaborate with municipalities on this issue. But at the same time, in practice, this so far has been very, very limited.
Tiho, I must say, one of the things that your answer shows is also something remarked by the committee, and that is your deep knowledge, not only of the cases that you studied, but also of the political and the regulatory context of, for instance, Greece. And I think the fact that you could read both Greek and Italian and speak it very well really made a difference in your analysis. And one of the things that was remarked over and over again is one can't compare in any way Italy and Greece, but one can look very closely at case studies and from there on derive larger patterns. Now, one of those patterns that you pull out and that I found really, really heartening in a way is that human rights can be relevant, that human rights can make a difference. You started off, I think, thinking the opposite, which is a good skeptical way of approaching a topic. But I think you walked out stating that in some cases, in some ways, in the hands of some people, human rights can make a difference. And you described that in looking at the city of Bologna as a human rights city. Now, this is a chapter in the PhD. That's an article in a forthcoming book that will probably only be out at the end of next year. So those listening will either have to email you to learn more about it, but won't be able to read it online anywhere yet. But let me make use of this opportunity to ask you a bit about that case study of Bologna. Bologna as a human rights city and the relevance of this identity to the way in which the city received integrated refugees. What's there to say about this? And what's there also to learn from this, again, for wider debates?
When it comes to the relationship between cities and human rights, when I was reading the literature that has been published in the last years on this topic, I noticed as fascinating as this literature is, it predominantly focuses on the relationship between the city, the local level on the one hand, and the human rights as in at the international level on the other, be it relationships between the local governments with international organizations, as we mentioned, or international human rights bodies, committees, etc. In this respect, I was impressed that this literature has not paid closer attention to the intergovernmental relationships within certain states and how certain conflicts, for example, between local and national authorities can play a role in the activation at the local level of this human rights discourse, use of human rights legally, if you wish, or also as a practice. And this I really understood much better when I looked at the case of Bologna in Italy. In Italy, for many years, we have certain dispute between the national and the local level in certain cities, which is a political dispute about the understanding of immigration as a phenomenon and the contribution of immigration to the local level, to the development of the country, to the social development of certain regions, to the economic development, etc., etc. So these political conflicts between the local and the national level, in my view, reflected the use of human rights in the case of Bologna. What do I mean? From the 2000s, the so-called red region of Emilia-Romagna, where Bologna is located, center-left, politically speaking, region, started using first discursively, but also embedding it in local regional legal instruments in order to justify certain progressive policies for locally present immigrants. They did this, the regional authorities and the local authorities started doing this in order to respond to more and more restrictive legal framework, political practice, and also political discourse from the national level at that time. We know that in Italy, there is a certain period in 2008, 2009 with very restrictive national migration policies that also violated certain human rights legislation. And also in the end of 2010, with the period in government of Lega, we have a similar instance of very restrictive national policies. So looking at the history of Bologna and the gradual engagement of the city, the local authority, the local administration with human rights, I realized that, in fact, this expansion, if you wish, at the local level of human rights reflected exactly this conflict between the two levels of government. And I realized that human rights can be a powerful tool for local authorities against certain, if you wish, negative, if you wish, xenophobic even discourse nationally at certain times, and against certain legislation at the national level that can violate migrants' human rights, and against also practices at the national level. Human rights discursively is very prominent too, because it's recognized as one of the most powerful discourses that is used by non-governmental organizations in order to build wider coalitions that would protect, fulfill the rights of migrants and mobilize people to do so. On the other hand, as a practice, human rights can be used to also educate policymakers and practitioners at the local level about the rights of the people, but also how to realize them with certain practices locally. And as a law, this is one of the most powerful instruments as well, which, however, importantly, in order to use it, we should have a certain capacity to understand it at the local level. What do I mean? If one wants to use human rights law in legal battles, let's say, with national authorities, then one definitely needs to have the expertise, to have the civil society to collaborate with locally, and to have a responsive judiciary, if you wish. Such an example in Greece, where the judiciary would be responsive and would accept the use of international human rights in local courts, is extremely limited. I don't think that this has happened anyway closer to the examples that we have in Italy. So in Bologna, we had this example, we had this engagement with human rights, and the effect was very positive, actually. I will not, of course, reveal everything of what I've written, because people will not read my chapter afterwards.
So I have to wait for another year, unless they send you a very kind email.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there is a bit of a comparison there. So you've spoken about human rights discourse, you've spoken about, in a way, the infrastructure, the ecology that is receptive or not receptive for human rights arguments. But if there's one key role in your narrative, if there's one type of protagonist that pops up over and over again, it's the mayors, right, Moritz? The role of the mayors.
Indeed. So your thesis draws attention to the role of mayors, and in particular, how they can shape local policy on the reception integration of migrants really in different contexts across the case studies, both in Italy and in Greece. However, you also highlight, if one looks at your arguments, the importance of the context and the environment in which these mayors find themselves in. For example, in chapter 3, where you adapt, and that's what you call it, an interactionist perspective, to describe this interplay between the mayors in Greece and, on the other hand, the social and institutional surroundings that they are embedded in. Could you tell us a little bit more about this relationship? And maybe to put this question somewhat crudely and simplistically, where we see proactive policies, is it more about a mayor pushing or about a mayor being pushed?
Now, this focus on local political leadership again stems from the review of the literature and my realization that, in fact, so many scholars have used, also in migration governance and migration studies, refugee studies, this concept, referring to the political leadership being responsible for certain local attitudes or certain local policies, and at the same time, never defining what do they mean by local political leadership. Most people use the concept just equating it to the role of the individual mayor in the certain area. And from this starting point, I decided that I need to engage more with migration studies, refugee studies, and to bridge them to leadership studies, which is a very well developed field of studies. And there is so much done in terms of conceptualizing political leadership. So I brought insights from these different areas. And then I decided that the most suitable for migration studies would be to adopt this interactionist approach, which means mayors are very important as individuals indeed, but they operate in certain local contexts. And these local contexts have institutional part. So what are the competencies of a mayor and local government in terms of migration, reception, integration in certain country, but also in general, what are the competencies of a mayor? Can a mayor, for example, appoint certain people to do certain tasks in migration governance, etc.? And on the other hand, of course, mayors are dependent on the local environment in terms of civil society, in terms of social attitudes towards immigrants, reactions of the local population upon the arrival of refugees, for example, etc. So the way that a certain mayor overcomes the obstacles that this environment poses and at the same time takes advantage of the opportunities that this environment offers him or her is what I conceptualize as local political leadership. And from that moment onwards, from this point, I bring a number of practical recommendations based on my study in Greece. And I recommend to local political leaders to pay attention to three aspects in exercising local political leadership in migration governments: politically, operationally, and discursively. Politically speaking, there is a wide misconception that engaging in migration matters is very costly, and that local population is by default negatively predisposed towards the arrival of any type of forced migrants. And I think that based on my research, I would say this is a wrong perception that local political leaders should overcome. The earlier they engage proactively and take measures, politically speaking, in migration governance and try to navigate politically the local context, the better results they would achieve for everyone involved, not only for the migrants themselves, but also in terms of social cohesion, etc. There is a widespread logic, not in my backyard, in migration governance when it comes to mayors. I think that mayors should overcome this logic and definitely think about how they can foresee what's going to happen in their locality and how they can engage in developing certain practices, policies, etc. Second, when it comes to the operational part, and here I use the concept of interactive political leadership and multi-level political leadership. In order to be successful, given mayor in terms of reception, integration of forced migrants, I think that one should collaborate as much as possible with local civil society, with the national level of government as well, with the international level of government as well. Why? Because this gives certain legitimacy of the practices that one develops. It gives access to funds. It gives access to know-how. It gives access to human capital as well in certain circumstances, especially in Greece in the last years, what we discussed with the collaboration with international organizations. And finally, the proactive engagement discursively of mayors. This is extremely crucial and the easiest way, in my opinion, to have not the results that one would wish at the local level when it comes to migration governance, is to give space to certain voices from the far right or xenophobic voices at the local level to flourish by not engaging proactively in navigating the discourse at the local level. And this, what I just described, refers not only to center-left mayors who are usually more proactive in this area, but also to mayors that belong to the center-right spectrum of ideologically speaking in terms of politics. I give you an example from Greece. Recently, we had this giant puppet that was traveling from Syria to Manchester, Amal. And this puppet actually crossed through Greece, through certain towns and cities. And there were negative reactions, of course, in certain places. There is a certain town, Trikala, in central Greece, which showed a very positive stance in 2016, 2017, when refugees were trapped in the country when the Balkan route closed. And this municipality is governed by a center-right mayor. The mayor back then engaged very proactively in hosting refugees. Actually, thousands of refugees passed through the town. And not only this mayor didn't lose politically speaking, but he was re-elected in 2019. And now coming back to the presence of Amal, he was one of the mayors that publicly was in favor of Amal visiting the town of Trikala, welcomed the puppet in the center of the town, and also engaged proactively in developing this type of local discourse of welcoming attitude of the local community, preserving social cohesion, not giving the space of other types of discourses to flourish. So politically, operationally, discursively, mayor should engage proactively in migration governance. That this is the way to demonstrate their political leadership.
This is really nice, Tiho, because it also shows how extremely relevant, also societally relevant, a lot of your work is, including practical recommendations. I know at the end of the PhD defense, you have to make a promise towards both science and towards society to act with integrity and scrupulously, and especially with independence and care. And I think you already show that in your PhD. Yeah, so now it's on to new places, right?
Yes, indeed. So for several months, you have now been based at a refugee hub at the University of Ottawa in Canada, where you are researching the topic of community-based refugee sponsorship. And since I have also been working with you on this team, and in fact continue to work with you as well, which is very nice, I know that you have had a long-standing interest in it. Could you tell us a bit more about what community sponsorship is? And of course, we have had an episode on this previously, but just briefly, and how and why you developed this interest, and also what you have found out so far in your current research project.
Indeed, few episodes behind, we had this episode on local authorities and community sponsorship. I encourage everyone to go back and listen to it because it was a very interesting episode. But community sponsorship is a practice which gives the opportunity of ordinary citizens to get together and to welcome and help refugees to integrate locally by providing financial support, but also emotional support and social support, helping them, linking them to services like education, helping them with job opportunities, etc. Now, it's a public-private partnership, of course, not only driven by ordinary citizens and civil society organizations, but also by central governments, which are the ultimate decision makers when it comes to allowing the admission of refugees on the national territory. My interest in community-based sponsorship started from this desire that my research would have some practical relevance, and I saw in community sponsorship a very important and emerging development in Europe, which could strengthen the European protection system and could increase significantly the number of refugees that reach protection in Europe in an orderly, in a safe way. So, of course, I initially approached it from the point of view of local authorities, a topic that we have been researching in the last years. So our publication with you, Moritz, focused on the potential of local authorities, basically, to develop such local community-based sponsorship programs and help their national governments and also refugees in general to help national governments to boost resettlement numbers. So I approach it from the point of view that community sponsorship is a complementary pathway for refugees to reach protection in Europe. In Canada, of course, I study a little bit different topic for the time. I'm focusing on the relationship between this type of community sponsorship, which in Canada is called private refugee sponsorship, and refugee integration. So how exactly this type of arrangement and this type of support of individual citizens helps refugees integrate locally through the use of certain tools. My research in Canada, of course, I have a little bit different focus. I don't look at the role of local authorities, but I look at the link between refugee sponsorship on the one hand and refugee integration on the other. In other words, how the refugee sponsorship driven by these ordinary citizens at the local level can lead to better outcomes in terms of integration. And there I focus on certain tools that these local sponsoring groups use in order to navigate the settlement process. Such tools are, for example, the settlement plan that each sponsoring group has to prepare for the arriving refugee, but also something that is a very important discussion now, also in the resettlement, which some governments are trying to look at and to implement, the pre-arrival contact between refugees on the one hand and their sponsors in the country of arrival on the other. Because this pre-arrival contact somehow is expected to help refugees already prepare better for their arrival in the country of resettlement, where they are going to be received by the sponsors. And from this point of view, to be better linked upon their arrival to educational opportunities, to healthcare, to the labor market, and somehow fulfill better their expectations, etc. So this is the focus of my work in Canada. And of course, we are going to, at some point, probably link it in the future also to my previous work on local authorities in Europe, etc., because we want to produce certain practical recommendations from this research in Canada that would help not only the Canadian government to improve its policies and practices, but also European governments to design and implement better community sponsorship programs, which have recently emerged in the UK, in Spain, in Germany, in a number of other European countries.
I must say, Tiho, I'm starting to see what could be called a Dr. Subchev approach of looking very thoroughly and also very methodologically at given practices, given case studies which hold promise, also doing grounded research on them and on that basis working towards comparative research and recommendations to improve the situation of forced migrants. So I must say, this is a very hopeful practice. Also, you having concluded this book, really looking at Greece and Italy, but now working on the same theme across the ocean and in different contexts, and undoubtedly bringing all those insights together again. So yeah, I couldn't have thought of a better way to start a new year full of Cities of Refuge podcasts. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Subchev, not only for this podcast, but also for all those years of nice cooperation. And of course, we'll be in touch. But I also very much hope that our listeners, wherever you are, will also be able to listen to you in future podcasts. So thank you very much. Thanks also, Moritz.
And let me add briefly two things. In the show notes, you will, of course, find all the publications that are available of Tiho Mir. So part of the PhD can be accessed in journal articles that are indeed freely available. And I also want to take this opportunity to finally, he has been supporting us for quite a while, but thank Sitis Yim Samnang for his assistance in producing this podcast, which keeps the quality and, of course, also the episodes going. Without his assistance, this would not be possible. So thank you, Sitis.
Thank you, Sitis. Thank you, Tiho. Thank you, Moritz. And most of all, thank you all our listeners also for your interest in these topics. We wish you a wonderful year wherever you are and look forward to being in contact with you. Goodbye and until a next episode of Cities of Refuge.